the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
A taste of honey, tasting much sweeter than wine.
Today we ask questions about what's happened to the bee population in the U.S. of A. Our guest, who has a difficult name to pronounce, will join us in a second. He is co-author of a book called Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health. And since I first heard about colony collapse disorder a few years back, I've followed the coverage in the mainstream media, but always had many questions. And this new book, Vanishing Bees, makes a stab at answering the questions and bringing you up to date on at least the state of science related to bee populations in this country. My guest today is, he is at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he is assistant scientist for the study of transdisciplinary biomedical research in the Department of Population Health Sciences, as well as associate lecturer at the Holt Center for Science and Technology Studies, right there by the lake in Madison, Wisconsin. And because he has a six-syllable name, his able publicist, whose name is Peter Bermudez, sent me an audio file to help me pronounce it. And so I'm going to work on my practice together. Professor, is that all right?
That's completely fine.
Okay, here we go.
Sinot Suryanarayanan.
Sinot.
Sinot Suryanarayanan.
Suryanarayanan.
Sinot Suryanarayanan.
Ah, Peter, I really appreciate that. And can I call you Cy?
Totally, yeah.
It must be a challenge to always help people with your name.
You know, I've gotten used to it.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, but it's also amusing sometimes, and I take it in my stride.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate Peter's effort to help me with that. And let's also acknowledge your co-author, Daniel Lee Kleinman, who worked on this project with you. So I explained before we started recording that during the Christmas holidays, I attended a party and met a new person who lives in urban San Francisco and was talking at length and not belaboring it, I enjoyed it, about his hobby as an amateur beekeeper. And he's been doing it for about 2 years. He brought some samples of recent honey from his comb. And I really just enjoyed chatting with him, and it kind of reinvigorated my interest in this topic. So I want to thank you for Vanishing Bees, a highly accessible book which does bring the science to average people like me. So let's start by talking about amateur beekeepers, but they're not the only people who care about the colony collapse disorder. And as you write in your book, beekeepers are not a monolithic group. They're hobbyists, a growing group who see themselves as environmental stewards. There are those who make their living keeping bees, some providing pollinator services, others selling honey. Among commercial beekeepers, there are those with relatively few beehives and those with many thousand. Some of those people ship them around to farms to pollinate crops. And commercial beekeepers, you say, don't speak with one voice when it comes to CCD. So in this book, you diplomatically, I think, traverse the range of interest groups who care about bees, but who have fairly different perspectives. And if I could simplify it to two groups, there are kind of the purists who would be considered environmentalists who want to operate with bees as close to the natural law as possible. And then there are those who use them for commercial purposes, who freely embrace the modern pesticide usage in agribusiness and in large-scale operations. And they basically seem to feel that it's the bees' problem and that they need to adapt to the new kind of high-tech approach to agriculture. Argue with me here, Professor, and tell me if I can simplify it to that extent.
Yeah, you know, that's maybe an oversimplification, Peter, is my immediate response and mm-hmm. feeling to that. That there are other layers and of differences in attitude and approach within these realms of hobbyists, environmental stewards, so-called, and also the large-scale commercial beekeepers. That there's a range of different approaches. In the book, Kleinman and I talk about three such sort of subgroups within the large-scale commercial beekeeping communities.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these folks who have formed a nonprofit group called the National Honeybee Advisory Board, representing kind of portions of the national honeybee organizations, they feel that that there are certain agrochemicals in the environment that are a prominent factor in the cocktail or mix of factors leading to colony collapse disorder and other problems with honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this set of beekeepers who base their sort of hypotheses on day-to-day observations that they've made in their own honeybee hives. When they take thousands of their beehives to pollinate crops, and they know from the farmer whose crops they're pollinating that the crops were sprayed with a certain set of chemicals, and they have noted that there is a lag or a delay in the effect that they see in their bees. So they take their bees to these crops that were treated with certain classes of newer insecticides,
mm-hmm.
Called systemic insecticides, and we can talk later about what that means. But anyway, a few months later, seemingly healthy beehives and bees suddenly collapse. And so this set of beekeepers made an association between these chemicals, which they feel are not directly or just knocking and killing off their bees, but are indirectly weakening their bees.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's another set of commercial beekeepers who really kind of follow the scientific literature, follow the entomologists and scientists who are doing very detailed work and experiments. And these sets of beekeepers feel like they have some sort of scientific background or knowledge to be able to understand where the scientists are coming from. And they, some of them feel like they can bridge the gap between beekeepers and scientists by being sort of middle ground people who can translate the findings of scientists to beekeepers. And they feel like the scientists are on the right track in the sense that it's really not chemicals in the environment, but mainly some microbial pathogens like viruses and fungi and different strains of these pathogens that are causing the collapses.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a third set of folks which are sort of what would be caricaturized by what you mentioned, you know, this set of beekeepers who actually think that there is no colony collapse disorder, and they would rather see it as a cash cow disorder, cash cow disease, which is bringing in money for the scientists by calling something like a colony collapse disorder, which allows for funding of research agendas to happen,
mm-hmm.
Just a way of bringing in money.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that really it's just piss-poor beekeeping And if you're a good beekeeper, you would know how to take care of your bees, and you would avoid such problems. And if you're a bad beekeeper, well, you'll have all kinds of problems with your bees.
Mm-hmm.
Just take care of your bees properly. Right? That's their message, and it's sort of a very libertarian, individualistic message.
That uh-huh.
It's really up to you as an individual to take care of them. However you do that, you figure it out.
Kind of the Ayn Rand approach to beekeeping.
Yeah. And it's really driven by the market. It's like a market-driven approach, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, if you don't take care of your bees, the market will get you.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are good beekeepers, they will survive and they'll do well.
I'm not sure the bees really respond to market forces, but I accept that people have a belief in that direction. Since you raised the point, can I just ask you point blank, has any of your research been funded by some of the agrochemical giants like Bayer or Monsanto or Ortho or Dow, any of the people who operate in that space?
No, my research is funded through the federal government, and so tax dollars through the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. And can we just rule out one thing? One of the early guesses or suspicions about colony collapse disorder related to radiation from cell phone towers and other transmission systems, either of electrical or radio frequency. Do you have any? Do you find that those arguments have any credibility, or have those been kind of ruled out as a key cause or influence of the CCD?
The short answer is those answers have been ruled out.
Okay.
Now, the slightly longer answer to that is, you know, imagine yourself as a, you know, as a person who has, say, a headache, right? And that headache can be caused by so many different things, but all one is seeing or feeling at a certain point is the headache. And there can be multiple causes of that headache, you know, especially in a complex organism like us or like in a beehive. And so one of the motivators that led people to think of electromagnetic radiations and cell phone towers is that the bees in the colony collapse disorder simply absconded, just left their beehives. And one of the ideas was maybe they had difficulties finding their way back. Something was wrong with their navigation system, the way their brains figure out how to come back after they have foraged somewhere.
Right.
And it's just was something mucking up their navigation system. And turns out that there can be many different things that muck up or screw with a bee's navigation system, not just cell phone towers, but it can be agrochemicals,
mm-hmm.
it can be pesticides, it can be microbial pathogens that actually a particular fungal pathogen called Nosema, if that Nosema is injected into, experimentally injected into honeybees, the honeybees will leave their beehive. They will just fly away.
Hmm.
And it's seen as sort of an adaptive, evolved response to prevent spreading the infection around in the beehive. They just go elsewhere and die.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of like a programmed suicide.
Now, this leads just to curiosity on my part, Doctor, because, you know, you're describing these tiny little creatures, and you've described a navigation system. You've described some level of intelligence where they know that if they're infected with something, they will go away to try to protect the rest of the hive. And you've also described the oddness of the flight that occurs when a colony collapses, because one of their primal instincts is to protect the honeycomb. So we're talking about very complex organisms
yeah.
that operate in this tiny little honeybee body. That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah, and one of the big points that we make in this book is that even though scientists very much recognize this complexity, the complexity of beehives, but also the complexity of colony collapse disorder. The approach, the actual experiments and studies that have been carried out to look at this complexity have been too simplistic. Too simplistic in the sense that there is an emphasis on controlling many factors and looking at the precise effects of individual isolated factors. And now those have great value to figure out precisely what effect a certain chemical or a certain pathogen has on a beehive. But when we know or when we have this consensus, there's actually it's not one thing, it's many things put together that are mixing and causing these die-offs. And scientists recognize that. The experiments are not reflecting that complexity. And that's a very big argument we're making in this book, and we're connecting this. We're saying that that this is not simply a case of scientists being not smart. Scientists are very intelligent in this case, and they know what they're doing. The issue here is that entomologists and bee scientists, like everybody else, work in particular fields, in particular areas, and each of those areas are historically evolved, meaning, you know, in different areas there are different standards for what will get you to climb up a ladder of success as a scientist. Mm-hmm. To help you get publications, to help you get tenure, help you get grants. What are the standards that have been developed to say that some piece of knowledge is a valid piece of knowledge? Turns out that those standards that have been developed in entomology are really based around this sort of looking at individual effects of individual factors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what scientists have been following. It's really hard to set up experiments that look at interactions between multiple factors in the field.
And in your chapter that's entitled Keeping the Research Disciplined, you air that out a bit, and you talk about the deficits of field studies that are intended to replicate the conditions that caused a colony to collapse. And at the same time, pure lab experiments don't take into account all of the environmental factors, microclimate, soil, and other things that may not even be easily identified that could have an impact on the health of the bee populations.
Right, and not just lab experiments, but also the field experiments that are done don't take into account those issues, those variations. So even though experiments are done in the field, outside of the laboratory, the approach that's taken to the field is essentially the same as that which is taken in the laboratory, except now it's taken in the field on beehives as opposed to individual bees. And the same issues that are in the laboratory, the same issues that are overlooked, now become really amplified in the field because, as you know, honeybees can fly off. When you're trying to control the exposure of your bees so that they experimentally get only what you want them to get, it's really hard to do that in the field because bees can fly up to 6 kilometers, mm-hmm. and they can go and access anything else in those 6 kilometers that can confound kind of screw with what you're trying to get them to be treated with.
And, Cy, a little bit later in the book, you start to talk about the role of the agrochemical industry and the response of the professional growers, the agribusinesses. And you say growers' responses, as well as their knowledge and ignorance regarding what they see as the appropriate foundation for government regulation and honeybee pollination practices in the CCD controversy, are, quote, heavily mediated by a handful of dominant companies in agrochemical industry. Now, in plain English, are you saying that they're in the pocket of these industries and they basically maneuver or manage the science to try to fit the paradigm of, large-scale agricultural production, which is aided and abetted by heavy use of pesticides?
Right, that's a good question, Peter. And I would say that it's not that they are in the pockets of agrochemical industry, that it's not as as plain as that. That yes, there are some who are in the pockets of agrochemical industry, but a lot of the growers and also scientists are dealing with things that agrochemical industry has set up, you know, institutions, standards, ways of looking the effects of chemicals, ways of managing pests on the farm, using certain tools, having access to tools. So it's not simply that growers are in the pockets of agrochemical industry. It's a very complex set of issues where growers have come to depend on agrochemical industry for even things like consultation about which chemicals to use on their farm and how to use them. And this is in a context where extension services provided by the state government have become reduced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we see the legislatures all across the country cutting down on resources that they provide to populations within their state. We see farmers being pushed, almost being forced to having to depend on the private consultants from the agrochemical industry who will tell them, well, you can use this product or that product.
But there's also developing an unhealthy dependence, a kind of addiction, if you will, because of the end-to-end dominance that companies now have. They own the seed stock. They then modify the seed stock to match their high-priced chemicals like Roundup. The farmers become dependent, and also they're kept in line by lawsuits from companies like Monsanto that crack down on Percy Schmeiser and others. Simply, you know, when their patented seeds blow across the fence onto somebody else's property. So there's a real fear factor in you know, large operations who want to challenge the science that is promoted by the agrochemical giants.
Yeah, and this is why the, you know, pending merger between Bayer and Monsanto is a real cause for concern.
Indeed. Let me quote another line from the book here. As a result, you say, growers go along with powerful agrochemical industry firms in signaling their willingness to ignore the interactive and cumulative ways in which systemic insecticides, in combination with other factors, may be responsible for accelerating declines in populations of honeybees and various insect pollinators. Furthermore, most growers' widespread preference for newer systemic insecticides relies on the knowledge and ignorance of agrochemical industry, government regulators, and the university scientists you just referenced related to the ag extension programs, who see these chemicals as the most effective and environmentally safe tools for pest control. But you don't reference the financial incentive here, the profit motive. And that is another factor to maintain high yields of certain crops. Many of these people are willing to cut corners on science and to risk the future of the pollination population.
Right, yeah. I mean, those financial incentives are there. And in a way, you know, we wanted to emphasize these other issues that are is in some sense more mundane, everyday issues, rather than the issues that get mentioned in media a lot of the times. And these are the issues regarding financial incentives, conflicts of interest, and corruption that happens from people with those conflicts of interest cutting corners and maybe even falsifying and kind of making fraudulent claims. Right? So these issues are happening in the honeybee case. We don't say they're not happening, but our contention is that these issues are happening in the fringes, and that focusing on these sorts of conflicts of interest and corruption issues takes us away from the everyday, mundane, more insidious ways, we think, in which science and capital converge to the aid of big agrochemical companies and to the detriment of honeybees and beekeepers.
Well, Cy, I take your point, and I defer to your deep experience on these issues. Yet, I am struck by this passage in your book. Bayer's insistence on the absence of direct causal evidence of harm from field experiments as sufficient grounds for keeping its chemicals on the market finds willing ears among some beekeepers, governmental regulators, and university scientists. Mm-hmm. And in the next section, where you kind of describe their strategy as highlight complexity, create uncertainty,
yeah.
That is the MO of the tobacco industry. And more recently, the global warming deniers. We just heard Ryan Zinke, the incoming Interior Secretary, mm-hmm. recite that talking point, well, I'm not a scientist. And that's how they dodge these questions. But,
yeah, you know, agreed.
This
I agree with you on this very much, Peter. I mean, when we look at the agrochemical companies, we cannot deny the huge financial incentives that are ever-present in their pushing their products all the time. Right? I've, in my interviews, in my conversations with these folks who belong to these companies, you know, they come across as really genuine folks who care for bees, okay?
Well, and they have billion-dollar advertising budgets to greenwash their image and talk about how much they care about these issues.
Right. Yeah, and so even though there are individuals who seem to care, they're situated in these profit-driven enterprises which are really interested only in pushing their products forward, and how they can do that while appearing to show that they are caring for bees. You can call this greenwashing, right? And in some ways, you're right, that they have, as we show in the book also, they have really leveraged the complexity issue of the honeybee collapses to their advantage by saying that, yeah, it's complex, there's multiple factors involved, and so our chemicals are not really in the picture.
Right, and they'll you know, keep up this dodge until you can provide conclusive slam-duck type information, and by then it might be too late. Cy, you also have a chapter about the Environmental Protection Agency, and mm-hmm. let's talk about it in past and future, because we're not really very solid ground here during the transition of administrations. But
shaky ground, yeah.
Over the past few years, how do you rate the EPA as it has addressed the issues related to colony collapse disorder?
You know, so the EPA is, caught between the proverbial devil and the deep blue sea. On one side, the regulators, if they crack down too hard, they are on businesses. They are seen as pro-environmental activists in the pockets of environmental activists, romanticizing, having these romanticized notions of things, and also affecting jobs.
Yeah, job-killing regulation. That's what it's called.
Right. And so, and on the other hand, if they are seen to side on certain issues with the chemical companies, they are being called Environmental Pollution Agency and not the Protection Agency. So they have a delicate balancing act that they have to carry out. So we need to recognize that. Now, given that, I have to say that that some issues that the EPA was very aware of in certain domains. Let's take the example of mixtures of pesticides, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Honeybees, the way pesticides are regulated right now and registered, when we are talking about honeybees, the EPA doesn't look at mixtures of chemicals, even though EPA scientists know that an individual chemical can act very differently when it's in a mixture with other chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
It can synergize. It can have amplified effects, even at a very low dose. But the testing requirements, the EPA doesn't require agrochemical companies to provide data on mixtures of chemicals. Okay. Now, this is with regard to honeybee issues, but and terrestrial organisms. But in aquatic domains, mm-hmm. looking at regulating stuff in aquatic domains, EPA for a long time, for about 15, 20 years or more, has known and has some way of testing mixtures of chemicals. Now, they may not be mandated as in federal law, but there are ample research papers that the EPA themselves have come out with in trying to figure out how to look at mixtures of chemicals.
And let me ask this to follow up here. What you're saying is that, for example, the marine biologists at the EPA don't share their knowledge of chemical cocktails with the terrestrial biologists who are focused on issues including the colony collapse of bees. So is this like the CIA doesn't talk to the NSA?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I don't think that is the issue here. There may be some kind of communication aspects to this, but my own inclination is to think that just there has not been a political willingness and interest to push resources toward doing this in the terrestrial honeybee cases. Now, coming back to the aquatic cases, now, we have to remember that these were research papers and they were not mandated through federal law to actually carry out those tests. So what I'm trying to say is that the knowledge, that the EPA was aware of the knowledge that they themselves produced for aquatic domains. And it's just interesting that the political willingness has not come to bring that knowledge to the honeybee case. Now, that said, these are not easy issues. It's simpler to test one chemical than to test a bunch of different chemicals. And one can ask, well, how many combinations do you want me to test? When do you draw the line and say, these many combinations are enough? Because, you know, Peter, we are situated in a landscape where honeybees are exposed daily to hundreds of chemicals, mm-hmm. hundreds of agrochemicals. So, you know, scientists have sampled honeybee hives across North America in various commercial operations, and they found disturbing numbers of pesticides and other chemicals in these beehives.
But it's not a direct causal effect that can be established, and that's why Bayer is able to use the strategies it does. Am I correct? You've got linkage, but you don't have direct cause and effect.
Correct. There is mm-hmm. no direct cause and effect in the field.
Mm-hmm.
That allows Bayer to say, well, as long as you don't show to me in the field that my chemicals are causing your bees harm, well, sorry, you don't have a case.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how it worked out in France. That's not how it worked out in France. In France, this argument made by Bayer did not fly. And the French government went ahead and took a precautionary stance by saying, well, yeah, we don't have the direct evidence to say that your chemicals are causing bees harm in the field, but the field as such, we are skeptical of any data that comes from the field because there is so much environmental variation in the field. And so we are going to rely more on the laboratory data where we do see good suggestive evidence that your chemicals might be causing harm.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on the circumstantial suggestive evidence from laboratories, knowing their limitations but still going ahead with that, we'll take a precautionary approach and put a temporary moratorium on your chemicals until we know better.
All right. So then, if I can put it this way on the scoreboard, France has been more aggressive than the U.S. EPA in confronting these issues. And now we have Trump promoting Scott Pruitt. He's not yet been confirmed as EPA director, but the Democrats don't appear to be stopping any of these nominees. And Scott Pruitt sues the EPA 14 times as the Attorney General of Oklahoma, where fracking earthquakes now happen on a daily basis and are more of a threat than earthquakes here in California. Anyway, Scott Pruitt is no friend of science, and he is a friend of the industries that the EPA has regulated. The EPA is now on a lockdown, along with several other agencies that deal with science and climate, and it's unclear when gags will be lifted on the EPA scientists and employees. So how concerned are you about the future of the issues that you care so much about?
I'm very concerned. In fact, I'm concerned that the arguments that we made in the book about improving the EPA's regulation are moot right now, because right now we're coming to a more primitive politics where the very existence of the EPA is under question, in a sense. So forget about improving the EPA. We're talking about is EPA going to be there as we know it? And so I'm concerned.
And what can my listeners do to support your work and to honor, your intention, which is to protect the bee populations and come to some conclusions or resolutions to address the colony collapse issues?
Yeah, that's a hard one, Peter. So, everybody can do their little part. They can play a little part, and many small drops can perhaps fill the bucket, but there is also an ocean, and let me explain that analogy here.
Please.
What I mean is that we as individuals can reduce the amounts and kinds of insecticides and herbicides we are using in our backyard gardens, and raise pollinator-friendly plants that would be providing a richer, more diverse landscape for honeybees and other insect pollinators. We can do that. But if you read the book, you will see that the main issues are rather more upscale, meaning they're more upstream. The issues are coming from the big agrochemical, agro-industrial corporations, from the way it's a systemic issue, and us individuals can do our little things in this system, in this agricultural system in which we are sitting, and they can make changes, like in the case of the urban beekeeping movements, mm-hmm. can make some changes to the health of beehives, but we are talking a kind of agricultural system, intensive agriculture, that provides us our food. And it's in this agricultural system, whose intensive chemical and monocultural type of practices have led to the demise of not only honeybees currently, but the other insect pollinator populations. So honeybees are simply the tip of the iceberg of a much bigger problem that's been going on here for the last 70 years, which is other wild insect pollinators, butterflies, bees, solitary bees, wasps. They're diminishing in numbers. And so what can we do? We need a social movement to change the kind of agricultural system in which we're sitting, and this has to come in some way from growers. And in fact, there are growers who are sustainable-minded. Mm-hmm. There is a growing movement of sustainable agriculture where farmers and growers who care for the land that they are using and who want to nurture that land and who want to nurture the environment that they're using to grow crops. Well, these farmers are now they're trying to take actions. Of course, their numbers are low, and the power that they have is also less compared to the major agribusinesses that we're talking. But the has to come from, in some part, from growers themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cy, the book is fascinating. I learned quite a bit, and I certainly learned even more talking with you today. The book is Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health. We've been talking with Synot Suryanarayanan. How did I do?
Awesome. I like it.
And Cy, do you have a website related to the book that we can direct listeners to?
Well, listeners can go to the Rutgers University Press website, and there, if they type in Vanishing Bees, the book will come up.
All right. Cy, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with Synot Suryanarayanan. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.